Vectis Radio.
Welcome to Maggie Talks To, a series of in-depth conversations with people who live and work here on the Isle of Wight. I'm here with Fran Collins, who is the CEO of Red Funnel, and she's kindly agreed to be interviewed today to tell us all about her life. So what I'd like to ask, Fran, is whereabouts were you born? Were you born on the island or off the island?
No, I was born off the island. I was born in Winchester Hospital in 1977 and grew up along the south coast.
Yep. And where did you go to school? Anywhere nice?
I went to school in, I think, primary school. We lived in a little village in North Dorset called Cranbourne. I went to a primary school there. And then my parents did that sort of 80s buying and selling houses. They bought ruins and did them up. So I was brought up under tarpaulins of black plastic with falling down walls. And so we moved up and down the south coast a bit. And I went to school in Lyme Regis. And then I went to grammar school in a grammar school called Colliton Grammar School in Devon, which is where I did my sort of formative years.
Nice. And whilst you were at school, did you have any ideas of what it is you wanted to do when you left school?
It's funny, isn't it? Thinking back on that. So I had two things I quite liked the idea of. One was to be an astronaut.
All right.
Be a bit of a childhood dream.
Yeah.
And the other one, I thought potentially I might join the RAF or be a veterinary surgeon. And I was actually an air cadet for quite a long time in Devon.
Right. So an astronaut, an air cadet and a vet, they're quite different, aren't they?
Yeah, I think it's probably safe to say I didn't have a particularly clear vision of where my career would take me. Aspirational.
So did you get any advice from careers advisor type people?
Yes. I mean, I have to say, I think at the grammar school, you know, that we had a careers advisor, and I do recall going through, I think there was a questionnaire you had to fill out. And I do remember that one of the options I was given was a mortician or a funeral director. When you're 13 or 14, that's quite an interesting place to be.
I think it would be. I've suggested you've turned that one down then.
Yes. I think for me, because I was at grammar school, it was a very academic school. It was a very good school. I was pretty bright, but not particularly academic. So for me, I don't think the A-levels university route would have been the right one. And I think going into vocational training, which is what I did, was definitely the right route.
Okay. What vocational training did you do? Or is that a silly question?
Nothing's ever a silly question, as we say. I left school at 16, so I did my GCSEs and got sort of pretty average grades across the spread of 8. And then I went into the vocational training for the Merchant Navy, which is a Merchant Navy officer cadet, is what we'd say with them.
All right. And where did you have to go for that?
So I started at the age of 16. I went up to South Tyneside College, so up in the north of England. And we did an initial 6 months of sort of pre-sea training, is what you'd call it. So a lot of that is almost getting, you know, learning what to expect when you go to sea, doing your pre-sea courses. And then because it's vocational, once you've done that 6 months pre-sea training, you then get allocated to a vessel. I worked for Shell Tankers. So my first ship was a super tanker, which I had to join in Portsmouth and then sail on as a training cadet for 4 months. And then you do 6 months two trips, I think it is, sort of a 4 month or 2 month trip at sea. Then you go back to college and do another 6 months. Then you do a year's worth of sea time, and then you go back to college and do your final year at college, when I did it, to get your qualifications.
Wow. So was it scary the first time on the super tanker?
Was it scary? I don't know if it was scary. It was definitely a little bit daunting. I was 17 at that point. Shell had a very good system, so they would designate some of, and they were all working ships, but they would designate some of them as cadet training ships.
Right.
So there were 6 of us that went out to that vessel, and some of them were my classmates, so they were people I knew. And I remember going I joined in Portsmouth International Ferry Port, which of course many of your listeners will also be familiar with, and my mum dropped me off. And of course I was, you know, don't say goodbye to me, don't need to kiss me goodbye, don't make sure you don't cry to my mother. And went off, yeah, to join the ship. I think it was, it would have been very daunting had it not been with people I know.
Yes.
Or I knew, yeah.
So was it different, totally different from the classroom, or was it similar, or?
Oh, yeah, totally, totally different. So
right.
Your routine on the ship, when you join a ship, and it's the accommodation on the cargo ships and things. Forgive me if you know this already, but it's basically like a almost a premier inn. It's, you know, you've got cabins and rooms, you've got a mess room, a dining area, you've got a couple of lounges. So it's, there's usually a gym. It's quite functional. So you join the vessel and you spend the first few days really getting to know the layout of the vessel and doing your safety familiarization and safety training, because, you know, the most important thing is to make sure you know what to do in an emergency.
Yeah.
One, for your own safety, but two, because you play a vital part in the safety of everybody else.
And you don't want to get lost either, do you?
Well, totally. You need to know where your lifeboat is. You need to know where your fire muster station is, your life jacket. And then you just get into the ship routine. And the ship's routine, generally, especially on a supertanker, it's very different to a ferry, for example, because on a supertanker, you spend a lot of time at sea getting to your destination.
Right.
You know, they don't generally go particularly fast. You've got so you'll be on the bridge for, usually on those ships, you work a 4-on-8-off routine. So that means you'll spend 4 hours of every 12 on the bridge and 8 hours off or doing maintenance. Yeah. And so, you know, if you're a junior officer, you'll normally take the watch that's the 8 to 12. So at 8 o'clock in the morning, you're on the bridge till lunchtime. Then you do a few hours of maintenance or things in the afternoon. Then you take a rest and then you go back on for 8 o'clock in the evening and work from 8 till midnight.
Right.
And you do that every day. And the only variation for that really is when you're coming into port. And at that point, everybody, you know, you have a different set of duties. You'll be doing the mooring, doing the cargo operations. So it's quite nice. It has a routine. It's a very settled life on those vessels.
Oh, it sounds like it, yes. Was the food okay?
Yes, I don't think I've ever sailed on a ship where the food hasn't been very good. And that there are three things that really matter to people at sea. When you're sailing on what we call a deep sea ship, so one that doesn't come into port very often or doesn't work in a coastal region, it's really important that you get your mail when you get into port, that you get good food, and that when you get told you're going to leave the ship, what we call your payoff, that you get the details of that when you expect it, and that your relief, your opposite number, turns up when they're supposed to.
Does that mean that you can't leave until they do?
It does indeed.
Right. And has that ever affected you and you're leaving the ship?
It has. I remember I was in Singapore once, very excited to get off the vessel and get home. And my bags were literally at the gangway and I was waiting. Are they here? They're not turning up. And the ship will not wait. So when the ship is due to sail, it sails, because that's the business. And my relief didn't turn up, so I had to stay.
So you had to tell them, you know, then.
Yeah, do the walk of shame, carry my bags from the gangway back up to my cabin. I was not a happy Fran.
No, I bet you were. No. So how long were you on the ship then after that?
So I think that one was a couple of weeks.
All right.
In that instance.
So were you allowed off eventually when you landed somewhere else?
Yeah, so I think my relief caught up with the vessel. You know, if their flights have been delayed, and then they catch up with the next. I mean, it's funny. It's even with your luggage. So I joined a ship in the Caribbean. It was a slightly smaller product tanker called the Euplecta. And I was joining just around Christmas time. So I flew out to the Caribbean and the ship's orders kept getting changed. So I kept flying to places in the Caribbean and then the ship wouldn't go there. It would go somewhere else. So I had to try and get another flight to get to the next place.
But they're trying to tell you something.
Right, it makes you wonder, doesn't it? I flew into a small volcanic island called St. Eustatius. I didn't join the ship there. I then had to fly to another, I think I flew to Aruba, where I spent Christmas Day in a hotel on the beach, which was not an unwelcome experience. And then I think after that, I flew to Curacao and finally got to the ship. But from St. Eustatius, my luggage had not managed to keep up with me.
Oh.
So when I finally got to the vessel, I didn't have any luggage for about 4 weeks.
Oh, dear. So how did you cope?
I wore boiler suits and I washed my undergarments myself by hand frequently, because, you know, also when you're on those ships, I was always the only woman on board, so it wasn't like I could borrow any clothes off anybody.
No. That wouldn't be very good at all, would it?
Not ideal.
So after you've done the your year doing out on the ships and whatever, then what happened?
So with that training, then once I'd gone back into college to do my final sets of training, because there's a big combination for shipping. I think what a lot of people don't realise is the amount of mathematics and law that everybody at sea has to know.
Right.
You know, when you look at, if you look at navigation, it's actually, we do something called spherical trigonometry for navigation vessel nav. And that means that a triangle...
Oh, I couldn't even say that, let alone you.
A standard triangle has 180 degrees, but when you do it with a spherical trigonometry, which reflects the curvature of the Earth, it actually has 360 degrees.
Right.
So those levels, there's a lot of classroom work that goes behind it, you know, why the ship floats, what its stability is, how you calculate the stability of a vessel when you're loading or discharging it. So that classroom time is really important. So I completed that in, I think, 1993. And then I was still employed by Shell Shipping. So I went away with Shell as then they called it a marine officer, because I have also got an engineering license.
All right.
Part of, I did something called a dual cadet. So I qualified as a deckhand engineer back in the day.
Wow. I've been a busy girl.
What's busy?
So after all that, then what happened?
So I did a year sailing with Shell. I was really privileged actually to get some of the experiences. I joined a ship called the SS Lima. She was a steam powered ship.
All right.
And she was built in the Hull and Wolf shipyard in the same year I was born, 1977. And I actually was on her in my first trip as a qualified officer. I was an engineer on that ship, and we took it to a scrapyard in Bangladesh. So that was an amazing experience, not necessarily one I would care to repeat, but it was a great, you know, how often do you get to do that in your career? And then I transferred from that ship to another, I think it was a petrol products, it was a petroleum products tanker out in Singapore. And then I think I did another trip after that with them with a crude oil carrier. And then I changed to Chevron Shipping, and I went to work for Chevron again on tankers for a few years. It was what I knew. I think with shipping units, everything from cruise ships through to bulk cargo, through to ferries, through to super yachts. But I quite liked the cargo ship life on there, and I was very comfortable with it. And then I did change a little bit. So after Chevron, I did some work with cable companies. So all of the telecommunications cables that are laid across the oceans and connecting land masses,
yep,
they have to be, first of all, laid, and then they have to be maintained and repaired.
Right.
So I worked for a couple of big name companies, so Cable and Wireless and Global Marine, as it then became, and also an offshoot from that, which was called International Telecom.
Right.
So I did a few trips with those.
So were you still the only female on board?
I was and generally the only female officer on board. I think some of the staff had their wives with them traveling, and with the International Telecom Group. Even then, I don't think we had any other women actually working on the ships, because on those telecom ships, you have your operational crew for the vessel, and then you have a really big crew that also does the telecom side of things. So people who are prepping the cables, jointing the ends of the cables, all of that kind of thing.
Yeah, so they didn't send you down then in a diving suit?
No. Don't think that would be for me, to be honest.
I can't say that I'd like that either. It must be pretty cold out there.
Yeah, I mean, the sea temperature, you know, obviously, the deeper you go, the colder it gets. A lot of those ships have got what we call the subsea vehicles on there. So that was always really interesting to me. I loved the learnings I took from cable ships, because I learned about how they joint the telecommunications cables, you know, how many fibers there are inside, all of the kit. I've always loved to know more about things. How the subsea side of things worked was fascinating to me. It was really super future for something that I was used to. So it was a really great experience.
Oh, that's good. We're going to take a little break now, and we're going to come back in a minute and find out more about Fran.
Vectis Radio.
Oh, we're back now with Fran, and she's going to tell us some more about her trips on tankers and things. A little question. Did you ever see the film Captain Phillips?
I have seen that film.
Has anything happened to you similar to, obviously not what happened to him because he had beaten up and guns and heaven knows what else, but anything similar might have happened to you?
Thankfully, no beating up and guns, but it's a really serious risk. And it has changed a lot since I was at sea. But when we were on the ship that we took to the scrapyard, we did get boarded by pirates. It wasn't, as we say, organised, sophisticated piracy. But we have all the ships, whether you're back then or even now, when you're transiting areas of high risk, we have anti-piracy precautions.
Oh, right. What are those?
So we start off with securing the accommodation. And generally, you'll make sure that only one way, there's only one door that is accessible into the accommodation block on the vessel.
Right.
We rig fire hoses so that we can use the fire hoses to defend the sides of the ship. We put extra lookouts on board. Sometimes the companies will employ external security forces to travel with the vessel. And we put things like razor wire and barbed wire around the edges of the decks to stop people boarding. And yeah. The challenge with a tanker particularly is that it has a very low gap between the deck and the waterline, what we call the freeboard in shipping. So it's very easy for someone in a small boat to throw a hook up and hook the edge of the deck so they can board. So a lot of it's about vigilance. And then the incident that happened to me, I was actually an engineer at the time and I finished my watch at midnight. We were at anchor off Bangladesh and we had a watchman who was patrolling the deck. So we'd taken a lot of these precautions. We didn't have any barbed wire or razor wire, but we didn't have an external security company, but we were being very vigilant. So I was actually on the bridge talking to the second officer at the time. I popped up for coffee. That's what happens on those ships. You're quite social. I popped up for coffee and then the watchman called up on the radio and he said, "We've been boarded. I'm coming back. And we looked out of the bridge windows forward and he was running down the deck and he was shouting into the radio at the time. He's like, "They've got bowlers. They've got a bowler." We didn't know what a bowler was. So we were kind of like, "We'll get to the accommodation. We'll get the fire hoses on," which we did. They followed him down. He got into the accommodation. He locked the doors. They got as far as the doors. It turns out a bowler is a very big knife, like a bayonet.
Oh, I'll stick.
But yeah, we had the fire hoses, so we put the fire hoses on and we could just deter them from that. So they didn't get into the accommodation, but they stole a lot of paints and mooring ropes out of the forward lockers, what we call the forecastle, the very forward end of the ship.
Yeah.
So that was one of the experiences I had from that. But it's very different to the organised piracy that we see now.
Yes.
Certainly.
So it must have been scary, though.
Do you know, when you're that young, I don't think you see the fear side of it because you don't really... With hindsight now, I think I'd probably be a lot more afraid.
Yeah.
When I was in my early 20s, late teens, I think I didn't really understand the risk.
No.
For it. And I, you know, that's the thing, is that we get a bit older, we get a little bit more risk averse.
Well, hopefully, yes.
Yes.
So after all that, and you've done your tankery stuff and you've been back to college and you've got everything else, then what happened?
So I had a bit of a glitch, really. I was working, it was the year 2000, I think, and I was working for International Telecom Group. And it was at the time when the telecoms industry, it did a big boom and then it collapsed out a bit.
Right.
And at that point, I was actually quite lucky. So I got made redundant about a week before Christmas with that. And I should have gone back to sea. So I thought, that's okay. I'll take a few weeks off over Christmas, have Christmas at home, because obviously in shipping, you quite often don't. And then I will go out to the agencies and find another job.
Right.
And I actually ended up with sepsis randomly. So I'd had a...
Oh, dear. How did I manage that?
I had an abscess in my chest cavity, which was misdiagnosed for a bit. And if I'd been at sea, I wouldn't be talking to you today. So I was very lucky, you know, back in there, everything happens for a reason. So I had a long spell in hospital. I came out and then I couldn't, our medicals are quite strict for going to sea. So I couldn't at that point get a medical back. So I went and did some typing. I did some temping work as a typist in a cleaning company. And then I got offered a job as a tyre fitter. So
as you would, yeah.
As you would, tyre fitting pays more than typing at the time. So yeah. I went and did tyre fitting for the summer, which was great fun, actually. And if you need your tyres changed or your wheels balanced, I'm your woman. So I did that. And then Condor Ferries was recruiting for a seasonal chief officer role.
Oh, right.
And I had a coastal medical by that point, so I could work on the, what we call the short sea sector.
Yeah.
And I applied to Condor and they said, yep, when can you start? Literally within a week. So I started working for Condor Ferries initially, as I say, on a short-term contract.
And where were you going to and from?
That was operating. It was actually my first foray into high-speed vessels. So I was operating between Poole and Cherbourg initially, and then the Channel Islands on the big cross-channel high-speed catamarans. So they carried around 800 people. They had space for cars, for 180 cars, and they went at between 34 and 40 odd knots, and they were the best fun I think I'd ever had on a ship. I loved it.
Did you put your foot down?
Oh, yes. No, I loved it. I thought it was going to be a six-week contract, but I really found that I loved high speed, that it suited me. I liked the company. And actually, I ended up doing 16 years at Condor in the end. Not all of it on the ships, but I really loved it. And Condor was a fun company to work with. I worked with them as chief officer on the high speed and their conventional cross-channel ferries. And then I was promoted to master in, I think, 2006.
Did you have to take an exam to be a master?
Yeah, so what the exams I took initially from the cadetship up at college, for those, you then, that takes you to what is now called an officer of the watch license.
Right.
And what was then called a class three. You then do more sea time and another set of exams, which was historically called your mates and masters. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you do even more sea time. And then you get the opportunity to go back to college for a third and hopefully final time to get your captain's license.
Right.
And that captain's license gives you the ability to sail on any ship anywhere in the world of any size. So as long as you've got, you know, there are some additional courses for things like working in polar regions or specific cargoes. But generally, once you've got your class one master mariners, as we used to call it, that's your ticket, so to speak. So I got that, and then Condor promoted me to master on the route.
Well done, you. So could you use your master's ticket to sail one of the red funnel ferries?
I could indeed. I still keep my ticket. I'm very protective of it, so I do my revalidation.
Yeah,
I do my revalidation courses every 5 years, and now keep it.
So do the masters allow you to do it, or do you have to ask? I mean, obviously, I imagine politely you would ask them, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I generally have to fend some of them off. So we have a lovely master, Suresh, if you're listening to this, even this morning said to me, "Would you like a drive?" But to be honest, I'm not current. You know, it's like driving your car, isn't it? If you've had a long holiday, and you get in your car, you're a bit more cautious. You're a bit more careful. We also have something with ships that you have to be familiarized, which is ship specific.
Yeah.
So I don't keep a familiarization for our ships, because quite frankly, if the chief executive is driving the boat, then we've probably got something quite badly wrong.
Yeah.
So, but I can drive under supervision, and Suresh frequently does offer me the sticks and let me have a drive, and it is the best feeling in the world.
Oh, that's nice though, isn't it? So moving on from Condor, how did you get to Red Funnel?
So when I was at Condor as a master, I sailed as master for a few years. Mm. And then I was invited to come into the office. I did a short project, I think, which was around maintenance in the office in the winter, which was quite common. And I was quite ambivalent about being in the office. And then the general manager said, "Would you like to come be the operations manager?" And I said, "No, thanks very much. I love being on the ships. I like driving boats. This is the best job in the world."
Right.
And he said to me, "Well, please, we're really short. Would you come and do it for 6 months?" And I said, "I'll do it for 6 months as long as I can go back to sea at the end of it." And that was in 2009. And here I still am ashore. So I was really lucky, actually. So that was where I started to pursue my career in business.
Right.
And I had a Condor. We had very good owners of the company who were interested. They looked at people who were interested in what the business side of things were, and they gave me a lot of opportunities. Mm-hmm. So I learned the Condor business, firstly, from an operational perspective. And I learned, you know, the health and safety, the governance, and then the owners at Condor, the Macquarie Infrastructure Fund, they were very keen that there was a lot of shared information across the other assets in that portfolio. So I learned about power generation down in Italy with the hydroelectric power stations. I learned about health and safety and turbine. You know, they were really good at bringing that together.
Oh, that's
cool. And then I got promoted to operations director, And then we had a change in leadership at Condor, and I did a commercial role, which was ports and guest services director. Mm-hmm. So it was very much focused on the customer. And then there was a further shuffle, and there were three of us that sort of split the chief exec role. So I was executive director for operations, and I worked very closely with the chief financial officer and the chief commercial officer. And that took me up to 2018, when a recruiter reached out and said, "We're recruiting for the Red Funnel chief executive role. Would you like to have a look at it?"
And you said, "No, of course." You said, "Yes, please."
I said, "Well, that sounds interesting. What's the job spec? What's the way the, you know, what's the aspirations for the owners?" And they sent it through, and I went through the interview process and got the job.
Yeah. And you're still here.
7.5 years later, still here.
And you're still loving it.
I really do love it. It's not always an easy job, but it's the team I work with is incredible. And what we do does make a difference. So it's a great company to work with. And what I've seen over that 7 years is, when I came into the role in 2018, I had a very clear mandate. The company had recently been acquired by new owners, and they wanted me to be very focused on the operational side of things.
Yep.
And the compliance side. And, you know, you will remember we had a couple of incidents in 2018. So we worked very hard on making sure our safety and our compliance was very high.
Yep.
And we'd got the business into a place we were comfortable with. And then, of course, COVID came along. Yes. And that was something that none of us had ever had to face. And, you know, I think back to those Sundays where Boris was doing his calls at 5 o'clock. So we all listened. You'll remember this, Maggie. We sit there and we listen to what Boris is saying.
Yes.
And then as soon as he finishes, my phone starts ringing. Everyone's saying, "Right, what are we going to do?" And I'm in there, "Well, I've just heard the same news you have. I'm just thinking of the plan." But it was great. You know, we were working with the team to say, okay, what are we going to do? How are we going to implement this? How do we keep the island supplied appropriately and correctly and keep the business alive?
Yes.
Because, you know, it was, and then I think the thing that was really difficult again was actually, how do we restart?
Yeah.
When that was the piece, we went into it as a team saying, we've got to make sure we've got to be able to start everything up again. Mm-hmm. But even then, it was much harder than we all expected.
Well, I imagine it was, yes. There's all sorts of stuff to take into account that us commoners wouldn't have any idea about.
But I think it was the same for everybody in every business, wasn't it? It was, you know, even around things like the distancing rules, the, you know, that piece. You remember we had that, the pingdemic or whatever it was. That was probably one of the moments. Me, I found myself on Radio 4 on the World at 1 explaining why we couldn't operate, because we had one case of COVID across the whole company from someone who was working from home, and everybody was banned from coming to work because they'd been pinged with their phones on the pandemic.
Yeah.
I think I only had about 20% of operational staff available. Yeah. So we couldn't operate all the services. It was a mad world.
It was totally mad, wasn't it? I think it's improved since then, obviously, because COVID hasn't gone away, has it? But it is more controlled, I think.
Definitely. But I think we've seen, you know, quite a shift then. Back in the day, and again, you know, when we were younger, it was if you had a cold or a sore throat or you were virtually dying of the fever, you still came to work.
Yes.
And now, and that, you know, I look back with hindsight and think, was that the right decision? Was it the wrong decision? Yeah. Because you probably infected the rest of the business, but they all came to work. Whereas COVID reset that slightly.
Yeah.
And, you know, that certainly that transition post-COVID that you'll have seen for us, we had quite a high incidence of, so where we had staff shortages, that
yes.
is because people were rightly saying, "Do you know, I'm not well, I might have COVID, I'm not coming to work."
Absolutely. But then you can only work with the information you have at the time, can't you? So
exactly. And hindsight is always a wonderful thing. And I think the question I always try and ask is, what would we do differently if this situation happens again?
Yeah.
Knowing what we learned from the last one.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's you can only make the decisions you make at the time with what you know, as you say.
Absolutely. We're going to take another break, and we'll be back with Fran in a minute or two.
Vectis Radio.
So we're back with Fran, the CEO of Red Funnel, and I'm going to ask her some personal questions now. I'm sure she'll either answer them or she won't. I gather you're an animal lover.
Yes, I have. Been a particularly a horse lover since I was a very, very small child.
Right. Do you have your own horses?
Yes, I've got four horses.
Really?
Lucky that I, Yeah, I keep them at home now. So they're definitely more pets than anything else. I do a little bit of show jumping when I have time.
They don't go on the ferries backwards and forwards then?
No, because I live on the mainland. I live in North Dorset where my husband's business is.
Right.
So we travel a little bit to compete, but not awesome. Really much.
And do you have any other pets?
I have 4 cats and 3 sheep.
Really?
Having sheep with horses is it's very, you know, it's a good symbiotic relationship because the sheep eat the bits of grass the horses don't. But frankly, sheep are a total pain in the backside because they escape a lot. They're very hard to catch. They're quite feral. They look nice in the summer.
Yes. Especially when they've been shorn, is that it? Then they look nice.
Yes, that's it. Yeah.
So you don't actually use them for breeding or milk or anything like that?
No, they're just there to, like I say, they're very good with horses, and the biology of it is also, it disrupts the worming cycle with horses. But I'm not sure my husband would want us to get any more sheep when these guys pass on their way.
Right. Shall we ask him? No. And you have
I know what he'd say.
You have 4 cats, you say?
Yes, we've got two moggies and 2 Maine Coons.
Oh, right. So Maine Coons are big, aren't they?
Yeah, giant cats. They're so. I'd love to have a dog, but clearly with my work, it would be very difficult. Mm. So the Maine Coons are probably as close as you can get to a dog in a cat form. You know, they're big, they're friendly, they play fetch, they're very sociable. And if you pick them up, they're like those cuddly toys. You know, like just a big soggy cuddly toy.
Oh right. So you've got to be quite strong to pick one up then.
Yeah, well, the big, we've got a boy and a girl, the brother and sister, and the big guy, his name is Nismo. He's he weighs about 9 kilos, 9.5 kilos.
Wow. Do they take a lot of grooming?
They need to be groomed pretty much every week, I would say, a little bit more when they're shedding. They do make a lot of hair, and so more than the grooming, you need to do a lot of hoovering.
Yes. Up to your knees in fur, yes.
Yeah, it's a bit funny. But, you know, the lovely thing with that, I think, the two things I would say is where you've got a commitment, whether that's sport, family, animals, there's something that's very useful with the time for your brain to decompress.
Yeah.
So I think I do some of my best thinking about work, and a lot of what I do has to, you know, it's the, how do you put all of the bits of the operation, the planning, the challenges, the successes, all of that needs to be fitted into the strategy.
Yeah.
I do that, my best thinking with that, probably when I'm mucking out my stables.
Right. Of course. So can I ask you, where did you meet your husband?
I actually met my husband at his business. So he has a car repair business.
Right.
And I needed my car repaired. And
you couldn't do it yourself?
I had an interaction with a deer driving into work. And I phoned a friend, a mutual friend, and said, do you know anyone who do car repair? And he said, go and see the Foreign Bodywork. So I drove in and I was in a bit of a rush. And in that kind of conventional, we started talking, and 10 minutes turned into 2 hours. And, you know, 2 hours turned into dating, turned into living together, turned into a wedding, turned into a very happy marriage.
Good for you. Well done, you. So does he mind you keep sailing away on ferries, or is he happy with that?
I think he's happy with that. You know, we were lucky because we met a little bit later in life. You know, I was always quite busy. He was quite busy. So when we got together, and I think if you're a bit older, when you get together, you're settled in who you are, what your lifestyle is, what your aspirations, your career paths are. So we're very comfortable together. Sounds, you know, a little bit, but that's what we know with each other.
That's good. Very good. Do you actually have holidays?
No, not really.
Okay. Don't actually go anywhere for a holiday then?
No, and I think, you know, we would love to. Certainly with my work makes it quite challenging. You know, I'm not very good at taking leave, if I'm honest, and I need to get a bit better at that. But I think I've spent a lot of time travelling, so I like being at home. We've always got stuff to do at home with the horses, or fencing, or you know, keeping things. Yeah, and that the house could probably do with a little bit of work. But there's that side of things. And then on top of that, I think it's just being organised in finding where to go. We've got some thoughts we'd like to do. And I was lucky, my friend moved to America last year. So I went to visit her for a few days at the beginning of 2025. And that was amazing. Mm. But planning some holidays is on my list of things to do.
Mind you, it must be quite difficult with horses and sheep and cats and things. You've got to have them looked after, haven't you?
Yes, and you know, even with the horses, I'm very, very lucky that I have a local lady to me who is a freelance professional groom, and she comes in when I can't be there. So, you know, if I'm going to be staying away, like for instance tonight, I have to drive up to Maidstone in Kent, so I won't be home, and the lovely Hannah will come in and make sure the horses are fine and sort of that kind.
So your husband doesn't groom them then?
No, he will help in sort of dire straits. He prefers not to do the mucking out, but certainly through the summer, if he wants to bring them into the stables or he'll make sure they've fed and they're standing on their legs and everything's fine, he's perfectly good at that.
I can't say I blame him. I wouldn't want to muck out a stable either.
So. It's an acquired taste.
So you have had a quiet Christmas, or were you working at Christmas?
So I don't generally take time off over Christmas and New Year. Obviously, we operate sailings all the way through.
Yeah.
So I had Christmas Day off and Boxing Day, obviously, and then the weekend. And then I went down to Falmouth to see, we had a ship, the Red Osprey, in the dry dock in Falmouth. So I went down on the 30th of December to see the ship and came home on the 31st. And of course, the 31st, unfortunately, was really busy. I was the duty director, which I shared with Neil, our operations director. And of course, we had that terrible fog.
Yes.
On New Year's Eve. So it was actually that. I fully appreciate how difficult it was for our customers, but I have to say my team on the ground did an amazing job.
Yeah.
It's so challenging when you're in that. We had some tech issues in the morning, which we resolved very quickly. But then when the fog came down, it was so difficult. We had ships that were waiting, ready to go. We had our poor customers waiting on the ships. Can we get out? Can't we get out? But safety has to come first.
Absolutely. And of course, if you're going into a port with the harbour master, you have to obey the harbour master, don't you?
Absolutely. And, you know, for that, I know we've had a few comments about the harbour limits in Cowes, but I personally, and as a business, we are fully supportive of those limits that were imposed following the incidents in 2018.
Yeah.
Because nobody really remembers all the days that you get it right.
No.
But everybody remembers the days you get it wrong. And those days that you get it wrong, you know, they can be life-ending or life-changing.
Yes.
So it's always a difficult decision, but the commercial pressure can't take precedence. We have to be so definite. And I was talking to my masters there, I was immensely proud of the way they behaved with the RedJet. It has slightly different limits, was able to keep operating so we could offer some service.
Good.
And whilst I do appreciate it's really difficult in fog, unfortunately, that's just one of those things that's beyond our control.
Yeah, absolutely. So one more personal question. The wedding day, where was it?
It was at a country house in Dorset near Bridport.
Mm. And was it a good day?
It was, yeah.
Did you all girls wear?
It went amazingly, actually. I'd always said that I was not one for a wedding, and we had it as a very, not non-conventional, it was a sort of a festival themed, unconventional. We didn't have bridesmaids, we didn't really have speeches, we just wanted, you know, we got married in a very small ceremony on the Friday night, and then we had a bigger party on the Saturday.
Very sensible.
And the weather, yeah, we were very lucky. We got married in a September, and we were so lucky that it rained all the way up. So the Friday morning, it stopped raining. The sun shone all the way through until the Sunday morning. And Sunday morning, when we were all getting ready to leave, it started to rain again. So we were very lucky. It's an amazing memory.
Magic. Well done, you. So we're going to wrap up now because the hour's nearly gone, would you believe? And it's been absolutely fascinating. Is there anything else you'd like to tell the listeners? Or do you think you've told everybody everything you want to?
I think the only thing I'd like to say to listeners is that when I look back at my career, it hasn't taken anywhere the course I might have planned or that I thought it would.
Yeah.
But there have been so many opportunities, and those opportunities are there. You know, I'm an absolute passionate advocate of vocational training. Mm-hmm. University is great for some people and for some jobs and careers.
It's not for everyone, though, is it?
It's not for everyone. And I think we should be really open to the vocational training. Mm-hmm. And to say to people, you know, if there's something you want to do, don't let what other people tell you stop it. People will give you advice and opinions based on what they perceive their challenges are.
Yep.
And I think when I left, said to the grammar school I was going to go off and join the Merchant Navy, I think it's safe to say they didn't feel I was making the best use of my education so far. But actually,
since then. Think you've done badly, have you?
I think that there's. It's very easy to get taken back, but actually, when you've got people around you that say, "No, this is good," at, you know, go off and do it. Give it a try. Never be afraid to try something.
Absolutely. And if you don't like it, say so.
Exactly that. There's many you know, many routes to Rome, but there's. But ultimately, at the end of it, do what you want to do. Give it a chance. Give it a shot.
So is that what you advise young people now who are leaving school and thinking, what am I going to do with my career? So I don't want to go to university, right? Fine. What else could I do? How about an apprenticeship or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing I think for young people is when I was at school, we were almost expecting people to pick their whole careers when they were 16 or 17 or 18. Yeah. And actually, your career can change through. And I think, as you know, now we've never had the opportunity to change careers. We've got people retraining as doctors in their 30s and 40s.
Yes.
There's so much opportunity out there. There is so much education that I sort of almost young people, I'd say, don't feel boxed in by what you decide to do.
No.
As you leave school, because that's not going to A, define your career, and B, it certainly doesn't define you.
No. That's very wise words, I would have said. Thank you, friend, for your time. It's been absolutely fascinating to listen to you, and I'm sure people will be inspired by your words of wisdom.
Thanks, my dear. It's a pleasure, as always.
Thank you.
If you'd like to hear this or any other of the conversations again, go to the Vectis Radio webpage, vectisradio.com, and you can find it amongst the podcasts.